Welcome to the Space Show, Len.
Welcome. Nice to meet you.
What's your role here at Tidman Miller?
I'm the operations manager and also deputy director of the site. So I've been here for 35 years. So.
And when was this place built?
This is we originally started the place in 1966 with an antenna that was called DSS-42. Which is now long gone, unfortunately. 1997, I think we retired that one. DSS-43 is still active. It's the oldest antenna in the site now.
So. And what are we celebrating today?
We're celebrating 40 years for DSS-43, the 70-metre antenna. Originally built as a 64-metre antenna, modelled somewhat on the Parkes telescope, but a little bit more robust than the Parkes telescope. And it served us extremely well. The first big mission that we supported with it was the Viking mission and Viking 75.
The landing on Mars.
So it was two landers that actually landed on Mars.
And two orbiters.
Yep.
Which you tracked for quite a long time.
My word. And I remember them well.
Was it very exciting when those first pictures came in?
Oh yes, very, very exciting. It's always the images, seeing what it really looked like. You always had this speculation, you know, the pictures back that they made with the early astronomers where you had all these canals and everything else. It's just fascinating. Then when you actually get there and you see what it really looks like, it's a totally different story. So.
Now, the Apollo people saw the pictures from the moon just a smidge before the people in America saw it. Did you get a sneak peek at Mars just before the Americans did?
No, we didn't have the opportunities there to do the decoding that we were able to do, so we saw it afterwards. But we still watched the video feeds that come back from the States, so we actually watched the control centres themselves, and we use it as what we call a glee meter. If we're doing a particular support and there's something particular that we've got to provide to the mission, there's the reaction of the people in the control room is our indication of what has happened and whether it's been successful or not. So consequently the glee meter is the term we use.
I remember the Viking landings. To me it was a radio event, of course, because there was no TV coverage. And I missed one of the landings by an hour because I forgot that America was on daylight saving or something like that, and I did the hour conversion. But I watched the first one, or listened to it on the Voice of America, but I missed the second one.
Right. No, I unfortunately missed that, but subsequent activities I've been able to support all that time. So
after Viking came
Voyager. And also, at the end of 1978, we had an exciting mission to Venus called Pioneer Venus. Mm-hmm. It was two spacecraft. It initially started off as two spacecraft, Pioneer 12, which was to go into orbit around Venus and study the atmosphere and so on for an extended period of time, and also Pioneer 13, which had four spacecraft on it. There was four probes, three small probes and one large probe. And they actually entered the atmosphere in December 1978.
Was that a tense time waiting for them to see if they worked properly?
Oh, yes, definitely, because each of the probes had been released from Pioneer 13 56 days, I think it was, before we actually got to Venus. The idea was that they spread themselves out as they left the probe and then entered the atmosphere at different points, so that we got a larger 3D image, if you like, of the atmosphere of Venus. So the three probes spread out, and the fourth probe, the large probe, went directly in the line of flight.
And those probes were not transmitting from when they separated until just before entry. Say it, because they were battery operated.
Yes, they were battery operated. So they had a battery life of about 56 minutes once they switched on. Three of them stopped. One of them, small probe two, landed on the surface and continued to transmit, and it actually dumped all the data that was in the memory and then started again before it failed. So it was an outstanding success.
And what came after Pioneer Venus?
Well, then we started the encounters for the Viking, for Voyager 1 was the encounter with Jupiter. Unfortunately, we had a bad storm the night of the red spot observations, but nonetheless, we still got some fantastic imagery. Then Voyager 2 came a little bit later on, and we also had the fluke with Io and finding the active volcanoes on Io. One of the navigators at JPL was actually trying to find a star for navigation purposes. So she actually enhanced the image, and the eye happened to be also in that frame, and she noticed the funny aura coming off the space, off the moon. And close investigation, they realised it was actually an active volcano.
The first active volcano found off the Earth.
Yeah. So from there on, we then started to look at Io a lot more closely and found that it had a number of active volcanoes. So it's really exciting.
So even the New Horizons on its way to Pluto had a look at Io.
Yes, that's right, it did. And it continues on merrily. We're going to wake it back up again shortly in preparations for a test run of the sequence for Pluto encounter, which is still over 12 months away. So,
when Voyager was launched and then a year or so or some months later went past Jupiter, did you believe that 40 years later you'd still be tracking it?
Oh, absolutely. The expectation is that we should be able to track Voyager 2 with its larger battery until about 2020. Voyager 1 had a smaller battery, so we expect it to die a couple of years beforehand. But nonetheless, we expect it to travel, to track them at least until 2020.
And what's Voyager telling you now?
Voyager's, most of the instruments are switched off. The magnetometers are the things that we've got running most now. They're on a 40-foot boom. There's two magnetometers, one halfway along the boom, one at the full length of the boom. And we use those to detect, or to try to detect, any changes in the environment around the spacecraft, which will give us some sort of an indication of whether we've reached that heliopause and the magnetosheath.
Yeah, which is the boundary between planetary space and interstellar space.
Correct. Correct.
So, it'd be pretty exciting to know that you're tracking something that's now interstellar space.
That's right, absolutely. You know, Voyager 1 is considerably further away than Voyager 2. Voyager 2, we track here in the Southern Hemisphere exclusively. Voyager 2 became what's known as a Southern Hemisphere object only some years ago. We see it for about 26 hours a day. So that's a little bit longer than a full day.
During the 1980s, when Voyager was heading out, there was hardly anything in the way of planetary missions. There was a bit of a lull. Now there's almost one every few months. Is that difficult for you to keep up with all those?
No, because the funding is a challenge for us at the moment. With the financial challenges that the US are suffering, we're not seeing as many missions being prepared. There's nowhere near the amount of money to throw at them. So NASA's looking at continuing to use some of the spacecraft that we've currently got and extending those missions to allow us to do some of the science that we want to do. Not ideally, but we're making the most of where we are with each of the spacecraft and maximising the data returns from those spacecraft at a much lower cost than trying to build a spacecraft from scratch, which usually ends up costing you many hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yes, that, for example, has happened to the Deep Space mission, which became Epoxy, didn't it?
Yes. And it continues to work. It's performing very, very well still.
So what's coming up in the future?
Well, we've got two new missions coming up this year, or three. We've got LADEE launches in August this year, which is another spacecraft to the moon. We've got a spacecraft called MOM, M-O-M. Not the American MOM, it's the Indians sending a spacecraft to Mars. Their goal is to get to Mars. And they launched that in October. And then in November, we've got a spacecraft called MAVEN, which is going to Mars. And MAVEN's goal is to try and learn more about the atmosphere of Mars and try and understand what happened to the atmosphere. Why isn't it there anymore?
And that raises another point I've sometimes wondered about. Does Tidbinbilla track only American spacecraft, or do you get tracking European ones, Indian, the Japanese, for example, with Hayabusa?
Yes, we track a number of spacecraft. All the spacecraft, though, the coordination and management of those goes through NASA. NASA actually arranges the contracts with the various space organisations around the world, and then we support them based on the schedule that's provided to us.
And you track Cassini at Saturn every day?
Just about. just about. Not every day. Sometimes it's not in a position where it's going to produce great science for us, so we'll wait until it's going to produce great science. So as it flies past one of the moons, or the signal goes through the rings, is intersected by the rings, or the atmosphere of Saturn itself, then we'll do science collection. And we're still learning lots of things even today.
Now, NASA often has a little fun thing for the public where they can get their name on a spacecraft. For example, my name's on Huygens on Titan at the moment, and it's in orbit around Saturn and Cassini, and I think it's on Mars as well. do you ever take part in things like that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I put myself down, put my family down. Everybody gets their names, grandchildren, and the works. So I send then the certificates to each of my grandchildren and my children, showing them that their name is actually on this spacecraft or that spacecraft going to the Mars or to a comet or wherever.
Now, I don't suppose you have much to do with the visitor centre here, but do they get a buzz out of things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very, very exciting for them, and they encourage people as much as possible to actually put their names down. The visitor centre that we've got here is a public view for NASA and NASA's activities in Australia. And I think it's really important that we actually do that sort of thing.
And, of course, you've never touched the moon rock here.
Never. Nobody ever has. So it's nicely secured.
No, I came in this morning, I said, oh, you still can't touch it.
No, that's right. You still can't touch it, never will.
But you've touched moon rock overseas, I presume?
No, I haven't.
Oh,
no,
really?
No, that's all in arrangements. So, yeah.
Oh, well, that's something you have to do when you visit places like the Kennedy Space Center or the Air and Space Museum in Washington.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so, yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us on the Space Show, Len.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much, Andrew.